like it was understood that certain things were certain ways. Mm-hmm. Like it was understood that women really didn't have a place to instigate or be the positive, the active part in any situation, although they were very active. They were, their parts were submissive. It was like always passive, even if it was a very active part, like say for instance Sadie, Katie, and Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
Going out and actually doing a lot of killing and murdering and stabbing. That isn't too passive of a part, but still they were just told to. Wasn't their idea.
That was Paul Watkins, a former member of the Charles Manson terrorist gang, which on August 9th of 1969 became internationally known when they brutally slaughtered actress Sharon Tate and four others in her Hollywood Hills home. The next day, they also brutally murdered Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, who, Mr. LaBianca, was a well-known grocery tycoon on the West Coast. That particular case was one of the longest criminal cases in the history of the United States, certainly one of the most publicized criminal cases in the history of this country. And our guest today on Montage, Vincent Buglosi, who was the prosecutor of Charles Manson and the Manson family, and also Mr. Kurt Gentry, one of America's top writers. And they have collaborated for an excellent new book called Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders. It is published by Norton, and the price is $10. Gentlemen, welcome to Montage. It's nice to have you with
us. Happy to be here, Bruce.
Mr. Buglosi, let me turn to you first, and first of all, find out, how did you hear that you were going to be the prosecutor in the Charles Manson case? Was it automatic, or were you selected?
Well, obviously, I was selected. There's 450 lawyers in that office, and certainly a case of this magnitude, they don't just take a name out of a hat. They want to make sure that these people are taken off the streets and convicted, and I was very honored that I was selected out of the 450 lawyers to prosecute Manson.
Several weeks ago, there was a television show on called The Law, and it got very good reviews. And one of the things in that particular story was that they, again, it was a very controversial case. There were obviously similarities between that particular case and the Manson case, where an aggressive young attorney as a part of the prosecuting team was selected.
Mm-hmm.
And was given the job and given a lot of press. And the reason that he was selected was for political purposes, because eventually he would want to go into politics.
Mm-hmm.
In your particular case, you have since run for office a couple of times.
Right.
You've been unsuccessful.
Right.
Was there any possibility that you were selected for that purpose?
Well, Bruce, I hate to make a sarcastic remark, but when seven people are in their graves, don't you really think that the DA wants to make sure that the killers are taken off the streets? Isn't that the main consideration?
I didn't say that the main consideration. Right. I'm saying, was that part of the consideration, do you feel?
You mean that my superiors wanted me to run for a public office and they wanted to give me exposure? That is totally totally absurd.
I think one of the reasons it's absurd,
incredible.
His superiors were Republicans and Vince was a Democrat.
When the evidence came in, and again, I cannot overestimate the fact that the amount of press coverage, not only in California, but throughout the world. I think people listening to the program today can maybe draw some correlation between the Tate LaBianca murders and the Richard Speck murders, which were just everywhere. And everyone on the street was talking about it.
Right.
How did you go about gathering evidence against the Manson family?
Well, the typical role, as pointed out in the book, Bruce, of a prosecutor is to be the lawyer in court for the people, and it's not his role to go out and investigate and gather evidence. That's the role of the law enforcement agencies, in this case the Los Angeles Police Department. However, I've never been restricted by that rather limited role. In every case that I've handled, and this was my 13th murder trial, I actually went out into the field, interviewed over 100 witnesses. I think it's much more effective that way when the prosecutor has actually interviewed the witnesses, so that when he ultimately calls them to the witness stand, he's much more acquainted with their anticipated testimony. So I got involved in the investigation of these murders, joining with the LAPD, and it was simply by interviewing people over and over and over again that I was able to establish the incredible far-out motive for these murders, which, as you know, is to start a black-white war, which Manson called Helter Skelter, and that's the title of the book.
And we should mention that it was his belief. First of all, he had spent most of his adult and juvenile life in prison. I think he had been convicted, what, 50 times by the time he was 37
Kurt
years
old? Kurt has checked this out in great detail, and he might be able to tell you about
it. By the time he was released in 1967, he'd been in institutions of one kind or another, from reform schools to prisons, 17 of those years, of his 32 years, more than half his life.
And it was his belief, because he had spent so much time in prison and because of the predominance of blacks in the U.S. prisons at this particular time and at that particular time, he felt that if there was a black-white war, that the blacks would win, and that, but yet they would be unintelligent, and they would not be able to run the country, and then he and his followers could come down from the mountain and save the world.
Coming down from the mountain, they were going to come up from the
valley,
bottom of the desert.
Right? He felt Manson was a racist, and he felt that blacks were subhuman and less evolved than the white man. And he said that the black man only knew what Whitey had told him to do, and the way he described it, in fact, to Paul Watkins, whom you a tape recording which you played on the show. He told Paul that once the black man turned over the reins of power to Charlie, he would pat Blackie on his kinky head and kick him in his butt and send him on his way to picking cotton. So he felt that he and his family would be the ultimate beneficiaries of this black-white war. During this war, which he called Helter Skelter, Manson wanted to go to the desert, and in fact did go to the desert after these murders, Death Valley, and live in the so-called bottomless pit, which he got from Revelation 9, a chapter in the last book of the New Testament. And he told Watkins and the rest of his family that in the bottomless pit, this was a land of milk and honey, and there were 12 fruit on every tree. And while Helter Skelter was going on above, he and his family would grow to a size of 144,000 people, the 12 tribes of Israel, and eventually they would take over the world.
I think he also borrowed from another part of the Bible, a little bit more subtly, and the going to the desert, the Christ image. Of course, the Christ image was very big in the family. They felt Charlie was Christ returned.
Getting back to, you mentioned his racist attitudes. In the cut that we played with Paul Watkins, he was obviously certainly no woman's liberation advocate either. He felt that they should be in the most submissive form possible. And weren't they all instructed to have as many children as they possibly could to help get to this 144,000 figure?
Yes.
What was family life? I allude to things that images that I have that were helped created by a film that was out a couple of years ago called Manson by Lawrence Merrick, an excellent film document. It talked about the child, the way in which children were raised within the family. That it was a totally disciplineless society. What are other things that you have encountered? Kurt, let me turn to you for that one.
Well, Manson felt that the children should be completely freed from influence of their parents, society, the church, state, so on and so forth. He did this by, when the children were born into the family, by giving them to the other girls to raise rather than their mothers. So his feeling was that the hang-ups would be passed on. This, of course, is not a new idea. It's only new in the way that Charlie used it. The thing to remember during all this is, while he was preaching babies and love, and while the girls were talking about love for brother and all these things, the same group was going out from in the dark from Spawn Ranch at night and murdering complete strangers at Charlie's command. And yet they saw no dichotomy, because Charlie taught them that there was no wrong.
Charles Manson never killed anybody himself. He always had his underlings go out and do it. Is that correct?
Charlie was quite capable of murder by himself. He shot a man, a dope dealer called Lotsa Papa, that he thought was a Black Panther. He actually wasn't, but that Charlie had no trouble pulling a trigger and putting a bullet into his stomach. The fact that he didn't die, Manson thought he did, certainly didn't bother Charlie, but he did use other people to do most of his killings.
Who were the others that went on? I mean, how many other people can be connected with the Manson family as far as murders are concerned, other than the big names?
It's difficult to say, because, for example, in the death of Shorty Shea, a number of people were sliced him up. It's very crude, but that's exactly what happened. Some hid the pieces. Some did the cleanup operation, like hiding his car, hiding his personal effects. there were quite a few accessories to murders, so it would be impossible to say how many in the family were involved in all the various murders. We've documented a possible, we've gone into a possible 35 murders committed by the family. There was talk within the family. Manson himself bragged to 35 murders at one point. One of the other family members said that there were between 35 and 40 murders committed by the family. Now, how much of this is bragging, we don't know, but we do know that there are a number of unsolved killings that had, for one reason or another, resembled family-type killings, and family members were in the vicinity.
Yeah.
In fact, two as late, for which people were convicted as late as 1972.
What was the name that came up periodically during the trial was Terry Melcher, who is Doris Day's son. Mr. Bugliosi, how was he involved in this case?
Well, Terry is a record producer, and Manson, among other things, is a frustrated singer-guitarist, and through a mutual friend, he tried to get Melcher to record him. Manson wanted to have Melcher record him. Melcher heard Charlie, did not think much of his music, turned Charlie down. And this caused Manson to cultivate quite a hatred for Melcher. But contrary to what some of the newspaper articles indicated prior to the trial, Melcher was not the object of these murders. Melcher used to live at the Tate residence, but the evidence showed that prior to these murders, prior to the night of the Tate murders, Manson had already learned that Melcher no longer lived there. There are many, many motives for this murder. One of the far-out supplementary motives, certainly not an important motive, was to frighten Terry Melcher. Manson wanted to do that, and he certainly did do that, but that was not the main reason for these murders. And Terry, to this day, of course, is very, very frightened. He sees a psychiatrist very frequently. He has a bodyguard, and I think I've convinced him, however, that Manson was not looking for him that particular night because he knew he no longer lived there.
In interviews that I did shortly after the murders with Hollywood celebrity types, there was a great deal of fear, even when they were traveling the Midwest, they were fearful of kidnapping and reprisal. Is that, you mentioned it still goes on with Terry Melcher, is that feeling, is that atmosphere still permeating Hollywood?
Oh, I think it very definitely is. I think the people that came in contact with Manson, like Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and others that got close to him at one point or another, are still very apprehensive and fear their lives. But I think one of the things, as far as the overall effect to remember, is that these murders weren't solved for over 3 months. And in a sense, the Tate-LaBianca murders were a really great mystery story, in that for months no one knew who the killers were, or when they were going to strike next, or who they were going to strike next.
Well,
everyone else.
Part of their plans, and Sharon Tate, but also there were plans to get to Frank Sinatra and Elizabeth Taylor,
Tom Jones, mm-hmm. Steve McQueen, yeah. Yeah.
Was it Frank Sinatra? That was the one they wanted to string up and skin mm-hmm. him alive.
Skin him alive and then sell his skin to hippie shops, so they said everyone could have a piece of Frank.
I don't think some of these people realized how close they came to death at the hands of the family if they hadn't been caught.
Yeah, there's no question that they would have continued murdering because, as Paul Watkins again said, testified on the stand, quote, death is Charlie's trip, unquote. He said death was beautiful. He spoke of death constantly. He said everyone had to die either in their head or out on the streets by the killing of the ego.
One of the quotes was, there was only true life and death, or something like that. Wasn't that one of the things?
What's this now?
There is only true life and death. Wasn't that part of the philosophy that he tried to teach to the family?
I might add, by way of footnote, however, that Charlie fought very hard for his own life, but he thought the death of other human beings was beautiful, and the songs he wrote contained frequent references to death, so he had a very morbid, strong preoccupation with death.
He preached against killing snakes, killing any animals. He berated people for stepping on flowers, and yet he had nothing against taking the life of a human being.
When you try to trace a human being like this, again, we talked about that he spent most of his adult life and 17 years of his life in prison. He was also, I believe, the son of a prostitute in the streets of Cincinnati. Now, again, there are some people saying, well, what chance did the man have? But yet there are other people who have come from that same background and have not done the horrendous things that he did. In looking into the this book, by the way, Helter Skelter, is not only about the trial, but it tries to look into Charles Manson. And what are some of the things that you found in looking into that personality, Mr. Bugliosi?
Well, he's obviously a very troubled individual. The book, in a sense, is an indictment on our criminal system, because Manson spent the majority of his life behind bars, either reformatories, jails, prisons, and yet Kurt and I were only able to determine that he was examined three times in all these years, over 20 years, three times by a psychiatrist, and then very, very superficially, and if anything, Charlie conned the psychiatrist. He had a tremendous hostility for society, although strangely enough, if you look at his criminal record, it's nonviolent, but unquestionably, there must have been a tremendous internal fermentation seething within him. If he had been examined in depth by psychiatrists, perhaps he would not have been released in March of 67. In fact, he told me, and I verified this later by calling the authorities, he told me that when he was released in March of 67 from Terminal Island, which is off Long Beach, that he told the authorities he did not want to be released. He said, "This is my home, the only home I ever had. I love it here. I don't want to go back out on the streets." But they let him go free. And he immediately went up to the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, which was in full bloom at that time, got himself a black bus, and started his family of murderers. But like you point out, Bruce, he did have a very deprived past, but many, many other people have had similar pasts and did not eventuate into a mass murderer. I think we have to point out that Charlie is not someone to be dismissed lightly, as some people have a tendency to do. They say, well, he's just a mediocre guy who gained control over a young bunch of kids with low IQs. That's definitely wrong. The people whom he gained control over did not have low IQs. Some of them had college degrees. They were rather bright. It's just that he was a lot brighter than they were. He's no dummy. The last IQ we could find on him was 121, which is not extremely high, but he was very clever, he was very insidious, he had a way with words, which I think he probably garnered somewhat from Scientology, which he studied in prison. And as Linda Kasabian described him on the witness stand, he's a heavy dude, he's someone to be reckoned with, a very powerful personality who was patterning himself after Adolf Hitler, to the point of apparently even reading Nietzsche, the German philosopher upon which the Nazi party based so much of their principles.
And this was read when during his period in prison?
I would imagine that's when it would have been read. He told Jacobson, who was a friend of Greg Jacobson, married Lou Costello's daughter, and Jacobson was the one that introduced Charlie to Terry Melcher. He told Jacobson that he read Nietzsche, and we find that as with the Nazi Party, Charlie felt that there should be a super white race, the Aryan race, that blacks should be subservient to whites, that women should be subservient to men, and that the only purpose of women was to procreate, and that it was not wrong to kill if it furthered some grandiose plan. Hitler's plan was the Third Reich, Manson's was Helter Skelter.
Well, there are great number of similarities from Manson's copying of the Rommel Desert Corps with his dune buggy battalions to their parallels in the lives of both illegitimacy, all these things. But I think you can just sum up Hitler's influence on Manson when, in one single, very chilling quote, Manson described Hitler as a tuned-in guy who leveled the karma of the Jews. And it shows how completely accepted the Aryan philosophy and how much it was his own.
He also said that Hitler had the right answer for everything. They both were very small men. I don't know how tall Hitler was, 5'5 or 6. Manson was only 5'2. They both had hypnotic eyes. Certainly when you looked at a photograph of Hitler among 20 people, the eyes stood out. They both were vegetarians. Both of their births are shrouded in mystery to a certain degree, because we still don't know who Charles Manson's father was. They both may have contained or had within them the blood of the very people whom they looked down upon. Historians talk about the fact that that Hitler may have had some Jewish blood in him, and as we point out in the book, from Charlie Manson's criminal history, his father may have been a black cook, and I asked Charlie that. Was his father black? I didn't think so. He certainly didn't have any Negroid features, and he said no. but his criminal records indicate that the father may have been a black cook. Both of these people, Hitler and Manson, surrounded themselves with bootlicking slaves who did their murderous bidding for them. Both thought that it wasn't wrong to kill if it furthered a grandiose plan. Hitler called people whom he did not like Schweinhund or Hund, whatever you call it, and Charlie called them pigs. We could go on and on. I don't think there's any question that Hitler had a influence on Manson, and if Manson had the opportunity, he would have ended up a mass murderer like Adolf Hitler.
We should mention that in the murders themselves, one of the things that was done, they smeared blood and they wrote anti-establishment, anti-police slogans on the wall so that the police would think that it was done by black liberation groups.
Right, and the most obvious attempt, of course, to frame the black man was when Charlie had Linda Kasabian plant Rosemary LaBianca's wallet in a gasoline station restroom near Pacoima, which is the black community of the San Fernando Valley in L.A. And Manson was hopeful that a black person would ultimately find the wallet and use the credit cards which were contained within the wallet
and get caught
and therefore be implicated in these murders. With respect to what they wrote on the wall, you might want to get into the fact that there was a definite, unmistakable connection between the lyrics of the Beatles songs and these murders, particularly the words, if you want to get into that at all.
Sure, let's get into it for a moment.
Well,
I mean, the title of the book, Helter Skelter,
Manson, as I indicated, was a
Beatlesque.
Was a very avid follower of the Beatles, and he believed passionately that they were speaking to him subliminally through the lyrics of their songs. One of the Beatles songs is called Helter Skelter, and those two words, Helter Skelter, were printed in blood on the refrigerator door at the LaBianca residence. Another Beatles song is called Piggies, and of course the word pig was printed in blood at the Tate residence and also the LaBianca residence and also the Hinman residence. I might point out that Manson has been convicted of 9 murders, including the Hinman murder. There's also a verse in the song Piggies which talks about wealthy husbands and wives eating out at fancy restaurants at night, clutching their forks and their knives. And the killers left a knife protruding from the throat of one of the victims and a fork protruding from his stomach. Another Beatles song is called Blackbird, which was recorded by other artists prior to the Beatles. And the words of the song Blackbird speak about the blackbird fixing its wings, rising up and flying. And the key word is rise there. And Manson told his family that by blackbird, the Beatles meant the black man. And the Beatles were telling the black man to rise up against the white man and destroy the white race, and the killers printed the word RISE, R-I-S-E, in blood at the LaBianca residence. One of the most incredible things, and Kurt can probably talk about this, about the Beatles song called Revolution 9, which I have to agree with Manson. By the song Revolution 9, the Beatles were in fact referring to Revelation 9, which is another place where Manson got his philosophy. You want to get into that? Revolution 9 and the fact that the words Charlie are heard...
Bruce, you've heard that song many times. And
right.
It's a montage of noises. It's not a song in the classical sense by any means. It's a little bit of everything. Snatches from the BBC, machine gun fire, pigs oinking in the background. And its title, of course, he was trying to make a parallel. I think the Beatles are trying to make a parallel to Revelation, the last book of the New Testament. But Charlie... And I think Charlie wasn't too wrong in this, that they were portraying what the final Armageddon or the final Holocaust would be like when people were fighting in the streets and killing each other. And the Manson family would listen to this over and over and over and over again with headsets, with volume down, with volume up every which way, finding hidden lyrics. And in the White Album, of course, there were a lot of hidden lyrics behind the songs. And, whether the Beatles did it just to put on fans that were always reading things into their songs or not.
To what extent were drugs... we talked about a totally disciplined society, and when you're talking about people in an impressionable age group, that sounds like a good idea. I mean, it really sounds great. You can do anything you want, and no one's going to say no. I want to talk about drugs, the use of sex, and the teaching of parental hatred by Charles Manson. How are these things used, Mr. Pugliosi?
Well, talking about drugs first, one point has to be made clear that these killers were not under the influence of any type of drugs on the nights of these murders, and there's a very simple reason for that. Manson wanted his killers to be effective as possible, and certainly you're not effective when you're under the influence of LSD. They probably couldn't have even driven to the two residences if they were under the influence of LSD. But unquestionably, drugs were used quite a bit by Manson and his family. Hallucinogenic drugs, like Paul Watkins says, we didn't use hard drugs, but they use LSD, marijuana, things like that. Drugs played a role in getting the family members to a point where they were able to go out and commit these murders. Manson used LSD very, very effectively. It's a mind-altering drug. It doesn't cause any damage to the brain as far as we know, but certainly when the person is ingesting the drug, when he's on a trip, according to the psychiatrist who testified at the trial, the drug makes the person a little more vulnerable and susceptible to the influence of third parties. So Charlie would use LSD in this fashion. The whole family would go on an LSD trip. Paul Watkins, again, the person you interviewed earlier, testified that Charlie would take a little less LSD than the rest so that he could retain a little more control over his mental faculties. While they were on a trip, he would extract promises from them. For instance, Paul told me that he made Paul and others promise that they would never leave the family, that the family was their home. And then when they'd come down off the trip, he'd make them live up to their promises. So drugs did play a very instrumental role in Manson's gaining this unbelievable control over his family.
They also had to break down all sexual inhibitions also, homosexuality also.
Charlie felt that it was a way to eliminate pride, to eliminate their parental influence, all these things. And, of course, to a great number of them, it was very enjoyable, the family orgies. But the orgies were, there were no inhibitions, no limits. If a person didn't want to engage in a certain act, whether homosexual, heterosexual, or whatever, Charlie would force them to do that thing, to break up that inhibition, to get it out of the way. And so he kind of eradicated the things that their parents' society had put into them.
Completely broke them down.
But in the process, he would always say, like he did to Paul Watkins and others, that he was deprogramming them. But in the same time, he was programming them in his own mold until they became just very much his abject slaves.
What about, I know one thing that sticks out from the film about the case, and that was the fact that they would go out and they would raid garbage cans, and they would eat right out of the garbage cans.
They would pick up, let's say, produce, milk cartons, things like that, that were, you know, a couple days over the date, or maybe there are a few specks on the produce or something that the supermarkets would have to throw out. And from all accounts, they made some great stews and good meals. One of the more humorous incidents was during six of the months that they were involved with Dennis Wilson, the Beach Boys, when they moved into his house and catered to Dennis's every need. They would borrow Dennis's Rolls Royce and go around on their garbage runs of the stores, which must have freaked out more than a few store managers.
I'd like to turn now to the night of August 9th of 1969. That was the night of the Tate-LaBianca murders. Can you take us through that night, Mr. Bugliosi?
Well, it's such a horrendous night. Manson did not accompany the killers to the Tate residence. He told the girls at Spahn Ranch to get a change of clothing and a knife and go with Tex, that's Tex Watson, and do everything that Tex told them to do. So they got into this car, a 1959 Ford, belonging to a ranch hand at Spahn Ranch, and there were four of them, Tex Watson and three girls, Patricia Krenwinkel, Susan Atkins, and Linda Kasabian, who ended up being the star witness for the prosecution. I might point this out, the only real mistake that Manson made was sending Linda Kasabian out on these two nights of murder, because she was a true flower child. She thought Manson was Christ, but on the night of the LaBianca murders, when he told her to murder someone, she said, "Charlie, I am not you. I cannot kill anybody." She never entered either residence. She never stabbed anyone. She was not cut out of the same cloth. And she's the one that took that witness stand and testified against Manson at the trial. So that was his mistake. So they drove to the residence. They didn't open up the gate by the gate control mechanism because they felt it might alert the people inside. They climbed over on the side of the gate on the hill, and they creepy crawled. That was what they had trained themselves to do. Creepy crawled up to the residence. They Tex Watson entered the residence through an open window, and then he opened the door for them, and the two girls went in, and Linda Kasabian stayed outside. I'm kind of getting ahead of my myself. Before they entered the residence, Stephen Parent, an 18-year-old youth, had been visiting the caretaker who was living to the rear of the Tate residence in a guest house, and he had been there a couple minutes earlier. And he was leaving the residence when Tex Watson and the three girls saw him. He was in his car, and Watson just came up to him and shot him four times. So he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He didn't have anything to do with Sharon Tate or any of the other people. In any event, once Watson and the two girls entered the residence, they caught the victims unawares. Abigail Folger was reading in her bedroom. Furkowski was sleeping on the sofa. Sharon Tate was lying in her bed. She was eight and a half months pregnant. Jay Sebring, with whom she had had apparently an affair many years ago, but right now apparently was just a close friend of the family, was seated on the edge of the bed. And they just caught these people by surprise. They ushered them into the living room. They shot Furkowski and Sebring, the two men. They took about 43 foot of rope with them to the residence, and they put a rope around Sebring's neck and attached it to Sharon Tate, and threw it over some beams on the ceiling and actually hung Sharon Tate temporarily. And then they just engaged in this massacre. There were 104 stab wounds. Collectively, Sharon was stabbed 16 times. She pleaded for her life. She begged Susan Atkins to spare her. She wanted to have her child. She said, "Just let me have my baby." Susan actually said that later she tasted Sharon Tate's blood. Sharon and Jay were murdered inside the residence. Furkowski and Folger ran outside of the residence, and they were murdered on the front lawn. It's so horrible. I mean, the thought of young girls, I don't think we've had anything like this in American history. Young girls dressing in black, arming themselves with sharp knives, entering the homes of total strangers in the middle of the night and mercilessly stabbing them to death. You don't even see things like this in horror movies. So what can I say? You know, Linda was outside and just heard these screams, "Please don't, God, no, you know, please don't." And,
one quote from a member of the Manson family whose name is Brenda that's quoted in the book. "We are what you have made us. We have been brought up on your TV. We were brought up watching Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, FBI, Combat. Combat was my favorite TV show. I never missed Combat." And she said that one of the reasons why she became as violent as she was because of the fact that the television had influenced her. Do you buy that in any way? There are other people, psychologists, have suggested that there's too much violence on television. Obviously, it doesn't always come out in such graphic terms as it has with the Manson family. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's so problematical whether any of their violent proclivities were traceable to what they had seen on TV. Certainly, that's a possibility, and I can't ignore that possibility. But there was one common denominator in Manson's family, and I don't think it had anything to do with what they had seen on TV, and that is this, and the psychiatrist testified to this on the witness stand, that there was a deep-seated hostility and hatred towards society. And I don't think that had anything to do with TV. Most of these girls were very troubled. They had a hatred within them, some of them even for their own parents. And they had dropped out of society before they met Charles Manson. And as we point out in the book, Manson kind of was the catalyst that transformed this pre, and I underline the word pre, this pre-existing hostility into violence and murder. Not all people are capable of murder. As I indicated, Linda, in fact, the majority of the members of Manson's family, they thought that he was a second coming of Christ. They would do anything in the world for him. They would give up their children for him. Some of them stopped short of murder.
Paul Watkins
refused to murder for Charlie and thought he was Christ. Brooks Polston refused to murder. Linda Kasabian did. Those that did murder for him, like Tex Watson and Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, and a few others, in my opinion, already had murder in their guts, in their system. A psychiatrist testified that some people have more homicidal tendencies than others. And he was the one that brought it to the surface.
And again, it also, we should emphasize, I think, first of all, again, at the time of the murder, they were not under the influence of drugs.
Right.
They were under the influence of Charles Manson.
That's right.
And again, these are not the run-of-the-mill, these were people that had their backgrounds were, for the most part, middle class, in some cases upper middle class, white, homecoming queens, Sunday school teachers, little league coaches, people that you would think would be in the mainstream of American life, and somewhere along the line they got off the road.
Yeah, I don't know if there's ever been a parallel to this type of situation in American history. We certainly have anti-establishment groups, but I can't think of a group like Manson and his family who preached love and practiced murder.
At the time of the trial, there were people that went out, and Charlie Manson became very commercial. They had Manson T-shirts and bumper stickers and everything else and buttons. And there was a vigil outside the courthouse each and every day. What about today? Are there still Manson followers on the streets of Los Angeles and throughout Southern and Northern California? Kurt?
I'm from San Francisco, so I'm rather more conscious of the ones that are up in Northern California right now. When the boys were sent off to places like San Quentin, Folsom, and Vacaville, San Francisco was the closest place. All at once, the families started showing up there, the ones that hadn't been convicted of crimes. It was during this period that they committed to people associated with the family and family members committed two more murders in Northern California in 1972.
Is there any indication that the Zebra murders were involved, that there may be a correlation between the Zebra?
It doesn't seem to be except in the sense that it was something like Charlie predicted, that a slaughter of motiveless slaughter of whites by blacks.
At the moment, Charles Manson is in Folsom Prison. Your intelligence sources, how is he being received by the prison?
There's been a little bit of change in his status. He was let out in the yard for exercise at some point and was badly beaten, according to the reports I've received. And he was transferred. There's a mixed feeling whether Charlie went insane or played insane, which he's a great actor, and apparently he was playing insane from all the indications. He was transferred to the medical facility at Vacaville. This was some months ago. While at Vacaville, he made such rapid progress in the psychiatric program there that all at once there's a little item in the papers that's saying that he'd been moved to minimum security, which sent chills up more than a few spines.
Yeah. Now, there's no chance that he's ever going
to
get out.
Just about 2 weeks after that, they said he'd been moved back to maximum security because he'd been caught smuggling letters to his followers on an escape plan. As for his getting out, Vince can answer that.
Yeah, he can apply for parole in 1978. He was sentenced to death, as you know, but then the Supreme Court abolished the death penalty, made it retroactive. So he can apply for parole in 78. He's not going to get out then. He'll serve a minimum, in my opinion, and I feel very strongly, of at least 20 or 25 years, and possibly he'll be in for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I would hate to be the official who would have to make the decision to let Charles Manson out. At this particular time, there are people that don't have a great deal of confidence in people in that position, but I don't think there'd be too many people that would let him out. Listen, on that note, we are out of time today, but I do want to say that, again, it is the most publicized criminal case in the history of the United States, and a fascinating story, not only the individuals that were involved, but certainly the prosecution, how it was gathered, and the whole story. The title of the book is Helter Skelter. It is the true story of the Manson murders. Its authors are Vincent Bugliosi and Kurt Gentry. They've been our guests today on Montage. It's published by Norton, and the price is $10. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Vincent Bugliosi and Kurt Gentry are our guests today on Montage, authors of Helter Skelter, which is one of the best-selling books in the country these days. On tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about cancer. It is a program that I hope that you'll be able to join us for. It could save your life. We're going to be talking about self-examination and also talking with cancer victims. So we hope that you'll be able to join us. Until then, Bruce Dumont, have yourself a very nice day.